We got a pretty solid quorum, looks like.
We do. How many?
Probably are going to have a full house when I get there.
Looks like everybody here. Hi, Joe.
Big crowd tonight.
Yeah.
Hey, Joe.
Good evening.
Tonight. Full house. Standing in the room to see here.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so this is the May 15th, 2008, Thursday, Zone 3 Advisory Committee meeting. It looks like we may have a quorum after Mr. Byrd queries everybody. If I could then introduce Mr. Doug Byrd, who is the County Hydraulic Operations Administrator, working with Dean Benedicts, and he's sitting in for Mr. Benedicts tonight. Good evening, Mr. Byrd.
Good evening, Mr. Gehring.
If you could then call us to order.
I think you called us to order. I'll call the roll.
I guess we made got us in order. You can call the roll for me.
Thank you. Pamela Dean?
Here.
Ted Ehring?
Here.
Chuck Ashton?
Here.
Joe Costello?
Here.
Jim Gehring?
I'm here.
John Wallace?
Here.
And Mr. Runnels?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Byrd. All right, so this is the time for public comment on anything that is not on the agenda. So if anyone in the audience has any comments on anything that is not on the agenda, if you could please step forward to the mic and give us your name, address, and what your issue is. Seeing none, I'll close the public.
If I may, Mr. Gehring, I received a phone call this morning from a lady I've known for a number of years, the Oceano Community Services District, and she informed me that today is Phil Davis's 45th anniversary working with OCSD, and she asked if we could just take a moment and recognize him for all of his years of service.
Is that a moment of silence you're speaking of?
No, sir. He is still alive, well, and with us. I don't think we need a moment of silence.
Phil, stand up and wave your hand around. Make sure we're still with us.
More or less in Oceano ever since, except when I worked for the county. And of course, we're all over and worked for the county.
Yep.
Anyway, thank you, gentlemen. You tricked me.
Thank you for your service.
Congratulations, Phil.
Congratulations, Phil.
Anything else, Mr. Byrd?
No, sir. Thank you.
Okay. The meeting minutes of March 10th, 2008. Anybody, or did everyone have a chance to look at them? And if so, any corrections or changes? Otherwise, a motion to accept.
No.
Mrs. Dean.
I'm to be a member, not an alternate.
Okay.
So. Oh, you're going to be the permanent.
Well,
as the delegate.
Eventually.
Yeah, good.
And Mrs. Dean, do you know who is the alternate in that case?
The alternate will be Jim Hill.
Jim Hill.
What happened to Bright? Is she still there?
She's not in the seat.
Grover.
Karen Bright is.
Oh, she's Grover. She's your alternate, isn't she?
No.
No?
Jim Guthrie's my
alternate. Well.
Ah, yeah. I get you and Grover Beach. He's a Grover Beach. He's that alternate. Okay. Alternate for Chuck.
So does anyone else have any changes or corrections to the minutes? Motion to accept as amended?
Second.
As amended, I assume. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
All abstain, Mr. Chairman, since I wasn't here.
By the way, since Runnels has spoken up, let me welcome you back officially from a leave of absence due to medical issues.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be back.
Yeah.
It was touch and go there for a while, but I'm here.
Welcome back.
Good.
All right. And thank you for all the people that sent cards and well wishes and all that kind of stuff. It was very gratifying.
All right. Nominations for chair and vice chair. Anybody else want to do this? If you do, speak up and nominate somebody.
I would move that we keep the same chairman.
Second.
It's kind of like when Reynolds was here.
Move nominations, be closed.
Okay, so we got a motion and a second. Nominations are closed. I guess we're going to have to call for a roll call vote on that. Well, let's make a voice vote. It sounds like it might be unanimous.
Yeah.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
You going to oppose?
I'm going to abstain, I guess. How about for vice chairman, then? Joe Costello was vice chairman.
You're the vice chair?
I move that Mr. Costello retain his position as vice chair.
I'll second that.
Anybody else?
I move nomination to be closed again. We might as well make the train go fast.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? So much for the railroad. Okay, Lopez Recreation Status Report. Don Mellon, I see you're here.
Good evening. Don Mellon, County Parks. I was unable to get you guys copies of the rec report, and I had an emergency I needed to respond to today, so I'm going to do my best just to give you a summary of the last month and a half activity. We had our Cal Poly Triathlon in March that was a semi-successful event. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like we're going to continue having it. We've had numerous problems with the number of volunteers that are coming out for the event and supplying enough medical supplies, medical backup. And while we kind of look at our events and have kind of a cost-benefit analysis when we look at them, and if we think it's going to serve a good balance of our visitors and it doesn't cost us too much in staff time, then we try to continue it. And we frequently get requests for special events. In this case, we gave it a try for about 3 years, and the number of problems we had just outweighed the benefit that we got from it. The first year that we had it, we had really cold weather, and we had 18 or 19 young people come down with hypothermia. The second year, we were overrun with some heat exhaustion, and they didn't have enough medical staff to assist. And unfortunately, we can't provide all of the services for them, so this event outlived its 3 years, so we won't be having that anymore. We had our Trout Derby here just a couple of weeks ago, and it was very successful. 400 people participated. None of the tag trout were caught, but they did give some money away, and there were some large trout caught. Once again, we had little kids catching the biggest fish, which seems to kind of depress some of the older fishermen, but that seems to be the norm for that event. As far as our revenue, we were up about 5%. The weather had a lot to do with it, which was not that much, but the weather had a lot to do with that. It was been typically fairly cold for April. We have a new playground at Mallard Cove that's been completed. That was purchased using federal land. It was a kind of an 80-20 match with some park funds and federal land and water conservation grant. But it replaces some of the playground equipment that's been there since the inception of the park, which was the slide and merry-go-round and swings. So that's really all I've got as far as a summary. I was going to do a quick presentation on what our response has been to the quagga mussels. If you guys will check out the screen here. I know at our last meeting we did just a brief discussion on it, and I'm not going to try to reinvent the wheel and go through an entire quagga mussel training here, but just in brief, native to Ukraine and Russia, came over in the ballast of some of the large freighters coming over, started in North America in late 1980s, was really noticed, quickly spread throughout the Great Lakes, Mississippi River drainage, and neighboring lakes. That's the distribution right now in the United States. You can't really see it, but it really runs pretty consistently along the Mississippi River. And once it got into the Colorado River system, it really spread rapidly and directly into the Colorado River Project, which infected a lot of the lakes in San Diego County. All of the lakes in San Diego County, I think except for one, have now had confirmed sightings, or it's hard to say what kind of an infestation they have. I know that they've seen them there. They don't seem to have a lot of information on how many or how quickly that they're multiplying, but they certainly have the capability of doing so. The identification on them, you can see they're about the size of a fingernail, different coloration. They look a little bit, the zebra mussel can be a slightly larger and have some stripes on it. You can see, just barely see there where it's, there's one attached to a rope. Their ecological impacts, they filter, these guys can filter about a liter of water an hour, which initially what ends up happening is your lake gets clearer. But then that can foster the growth of deep water algae, which then doesn't have enough oxygen to survive in the deeper water, decomposes and floats to the surface, and then can drift up on shore and begin causing all kinds of other problems. They absorb a tremendous amount of toxins. They are filter feeders, as I said. They do eat some larval fish, not really to any extent. They can cause huge algae blooms. They again make the water more clear. They increase the plant growth. You'll get these shell and mussel beds where nothing else can come in and live. They'll basically change the entire composition of a lake. I'm sorry, you guys can't read this very clearly. I'll try to read it out to you as we see it. The economic impacts can be a clogging of pipes, the intakes, the screens, boat motors. And the U.S. congressional researchers estimated that an infestation of zebra mussel in the Great Lakes area cost the power industry $3.1 billion in the 6 years between 1993 and 1999, with an economic impact on industries, businesses, and communities of more than $5 billion. In California, spread of the mussels threatens water delivery systems and hydroelectric facilities, agriculture, recreational boating, and fishing, and the environment in general. This is just a quick rundown on SLO County Parks' response. The first thing that we started doing was, once we really got wind of this, was educating voters through this Don't Move a Mussel campaign. We posted these flyers and posters throughout the park and began giving handouts to our voters. It's this one that you see here, the Don't Move a Mussels. It has the information on where the mussels can be found on your boat. This came out April 10th. This is a article in the Tribune. The thing you see to the left was an article in the Tribune talking about, it was after a press release that was given out, and then, of course, it was covered by KSBY, the efforts that we were taking. This is is our website again. I'm sorry that you can't read it. If it had been a little bit bigger, I might have been able to get it. Basically, what it tells people is when they visit our website is what to expect when they're visiting the lake. That I'm going to come over here so I can actually see it. Hopefully, you can hear me. It basically gives visitors who are planning on coming up to the lake what to expect when they get there. That they're going to that they have to be clean and dry, and that they will go through a decontamination process. When they come, what does clean and dry mean? It means drain plugs pulled, no water in the bilge, live well, or integral coolers, no mud, debris, aquatic weed, or algae on the hull, trailer, or motor. And the lower units on the boat should be dry when they come in because we have them drop their lower unit on their motor to see if there's water inside of it. And in addition, we don't permit wakeboard boats that have ballast systems that can't be examined to see if they're dry. Some of these wakeboard boats have ballast systems that sink them lower in the water so they throw up a bigger wake. And if we can't see inside the system and confirm that it's dry, they cannot bring it on the lake at all. And we've also included on here, there are some links to some of the other sites where you can get information on the mussels. We've been doing random... Let me get back over here to the microphone. Random spot inspections since January of 2008, and we began mandatory clean and dry inspections on April 4th. You can see a guy. That picture was actually taken at Margarita because both of our facilities are doing the same thing at this point. Both facilities were doing a decontamination using pressure washers that have 140 degree heat. The mussel mortality begins at 104 degrees, but they're recommending 140, which is what you can get a lot of pressure washers to. We go around the entire hull of the boat. The engine back, the plates on the back, the trim tab plates, the motor, and that's of course done after they're confirmed to be clean and dry through an inspection process. After that, they go through after they're completed doing this, and again, this is every boat. Once the boats go through, then we're permitted what we call our clean tagging process. Let me come over here again. It's really hard to see. What in a nutshell, what this means is what will happen is if you've been on the lake and you've been decontaminated and we're sure that you're okay, when you leave the lake, you can come back and we'll put a wire tag that goes through the
the bow hook on your boat, and we'll attach it to your trailer. And we have a crimping tool that gives our initials, either LRA for Lopez Recreation Area or SML for Santa Margarita Lake. And if you come back to the lake and that hasn't been tampered with, you don't have to go through the decontamination process again, because basically what it shows is that your boat has not been taken off the trailer. And we go up and we examine that, and we tug on it, make sure that it hasn't been taken off. And that is really was designed to cater to all of the local people, because really, we've determined that about 70% of our launches are local people. That doesn't mean 70% of our boats. That means 70%, because that means that the same people are coming out to the lake 2 or 3 days a week. And we really didn't want to penalize them through this and say, well, you know, they've never been to another lake. The only lake they've ever been to, and I don't know how many people have told me that, the only lake I ever go to is here. Well, through this decontamination process, we feel confident enough that we're hitting boats that may have been contaminated, but in any event, they have to come in clean and dry, even if you're coming from Pismo. You've got to come out, your boat has to be completely clean and has to be completely dry. If they come in with the clean tag, they go through, where the system's verified, we have a launch receipt that they get, and they're allowed to launch, and when they leave, they get another clean tag. If they've launched in infected waters, they're not permitted to launch again. If they have not launched in infected waters, they come in, they get an inspection form, we inspect the vessel. Of course, we have to get permission to do the decontamination. We inspect the vessel. If it's clean and dry, they go through decontamination, and then they're permitted to launch. They get a dated inspection form and a receipt and a copy to the boater. The reasons for rejection are water in the bilge, water in the live well, standing water in any compartment, foreign matter, aquatic weed or mud on the hull, motor, or trailer, refusal to go through decontamination, or if they have an internal ballast system that can't be examined. So that's kind of our system there. And again, the clean tags are only issued to boats after they're leaving the facility and after they've been inspected for decontamination. So we're not just handing out the little wire tags. You have to show your launch receipt that shows that you were there that day and that you've already either gone through the system or you showed up with a tag on your boat. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's both lakes,
yes,
Santa Margarita and Lopez.
Yeah, I apologize, it's so small. This is basically just the launch receipt. Shows the lakes that are infected here. It shows just whether the compartments are wet or dry. It's got the information on here. We get their CF numbers so we know who they are and we can do some tracking with it. This is our inspection criteria. Coming down, feeling the rope for moisture, checking the anchor rope, checking it. This is basically what our inspection protocol is. It runs down an entire area here, lowering the motor, checking the integral coolers, feeling for moisture, moist scum, wet mud, aquatic weed, organic material on the boat of any kind. And then the reasons for rejection. And then down here are listed the lakes that are infected in Southern California. And I think that's it for what I've got, and I'd be happy to entertain or listen to any questions. One thing I did want to bring up real quick, too, is where do we go from here right now? We are still collecting as much information as we can. We're taking as much information and as much leadership as we can that Fish and Game will provide. It's still moving across the state, the learning curve and the education on this. And you can really tell that by looking at what we're doing, what some of the other lakes are doing, and what the lakes are doing in Northern California, which is basically nothing. You're all of a sudden seeing them jumping on the bandwagon, particularly with Monterey County and Nacimiento Lake right now. There's a lot going on. They've got a training session coming up. They're even looking to us for training. And I kind of feel it makes us feel pretty good that we tried to stay ahead of it as best we could, and we were able to do this before our water purveyors forced us to or asked us to, that we were proactive enough to get this effort going.
While some of the other facilities are still kind of playing catch up, and I know that over Memorial Day weekend, they'll be setting up on Interstate 5, they'll be setting up a quagga mussel inspection station near Redding. And I think what they're doing is they're trying to head off people headed for Shasta, which you get them in Shasta, they go into the Sacramento River, which now you've got them in the entire Central Valley Water Project. And again, that's only for 2 days. They're only going to be checking boats for 2 days. So and I know at Clear Lake, you can go and have your boat inspected at the tackle shop and get it signed off. So there's a lot of different things going on here. And, you know, what we're trying to do and through our learning process is to take a practical and focused approach on this and really try to do some good. Rather than going through motions that aren't doing any good is, you know, we realize the implications for this, for not only for recreation, but the secondary economic impacts that we could see if we had a closure at Lopez Lake. You know, this is something that, as a whole, we need to be looking at. It's not just us. And it kind of disappoints me when some people look at us as the recreation folks as being, well, you need to take care of this. There are impacts that recreation has on this entire community and always has. And I can respect that from being here and using that as my recreation source for the last 40 years since I was a little kid. It's not just about keeping my job, and it's not just about making sure the lake is open for boats. It has a lot more to do with keeping this area open for recreation for the community and the region as well. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that anyone has.
Mr. Ashton. I have a couple of questions about your process you have going on. I was talking to one of our local fishermen in our town here, and he said he had went down and used the facilities at Kachuma, mm-hmm. and down there they went through the inspection deal, and he said he was charged $85. Do we have any charges we do for the inspections at this time?
No, and I was not aware that Kachuma was
either,
charging
but that's
either.
That's what he said, that he was charged money. And then what he was upset about was that if he goes to another lake and comes back, he's going to have to pay for that same inspection process all over again. And the other question in regards to your process here, we have the two lakes that we're highlighting, mm-hmm. Santa Margarita and Lopez there. Does that mean if you get inspected at the one, you can go over to Santa Margarita and don't have to be re-inspected?
That's correct, yes. The tags are reciprocal. And there was some question about that at a Quagga summit that we had with some of the interagencies. And, of course, I have to hand it to Dean Benedict's because one of the comments that was brought up from John Moss was, well, we don't know if we want to take Lopez's tags or not. And Dean said, well, I'm sure that Zone 3 would feel the same way that we don't know if we want to take Margarita's tags or not. So at this point, we're trusting the system, the decontamination system that we have. We also have been, several of us have been to some training on monitoring and early detection. We have monitoring stations in both lakes at this time. Fish and Game did dive Lopez here, and we haven't gotten the official results. We've only gotten some verbal information from them that they didn't locate any mussels in the lake at all. And so we know that at least at that point, they couldn't find anything. Of course, they didn't cover the entire lake. And we have stations. We have about, I think, 6 or 7 different stations that are in some different locations throughout the lake right now. And we'll be checking those 30 days from the time that they were put down and then every subsequent 30 days after that. So, you know, the way we look at it is until we find any different, we're going to go ahead and continue to be reciprocal. I don't see that happening necessarily with Kachuma. At this point, maybe later on down the road, we'll see something. I mean, certainly I'm sure that you're going to see a very big move afoot to get people to start sharing each other's tags. Well, you know, Nacimiento Lake has 13 launch ramps, and that's that we know of. So I don't know that I'm ready to take boats from that lake right now. So really, you know, we're just kind of entrusting both of our systems and trying to be as consistent as we can in our application of our decontamination process.
Mr. Reynolds.
My question has already been answered. I was wondering about the charge for cleaning the boat.
At this point, there is no charge. No. You know, I've had to hire extra people to do this job. We've had to have somebody at the launch ramp to make sure that no one's, you know, going around circumventing the system, coming in at night or anything like that. I know at some point, just like everything else, that it's going to get passed on. And when it gets passed on, it's going to get passed on to the users. Everyone that I've talked to seems to be okay with that. And it's really been interesting that the boaters, for the most part, have been very supportive. The ones that are not supportive are ones that don't watch the news, don't read the paper, and don't pay attention to what's going on. And they kind of come out with their hands up like, what's all this about? Just another government thing to slow us down and that kind of thing. And what we try to explain is this is something we really don't have a choice. We really have to do this. It's important not just for the water purveyor, but it's important for recreation and the environment overall. So.
Yeah, I have some questions.
Mr. Earing.
Being a boater, and I go up there quite often, mm-hmm. so I'm really kind of interested. Is the state moving in any direction to see that we could have some kind of a thing, like, just like you? That's a very good idea to mm-hmm. put a clip on there. Mm-hmm. And if that clip is from a lake that's non-contaminated, mm-hmm. but is the state moving in any direction to try and control this thing mm-hmm. so that you don't have to go through this? This obviously is a time-consuming process. Mm-hmm. You want to put 20 boats on there for a bass thing? You mm-hmm. got guys, you know, already getting there at sun when the sun is up. You know,
right? Absolutely, I wish I could say that there was more cooperation. I haven't really seen anyone taking full charge. I mean, we're trying to rely on Fish and Game because they are the authority for this in the state of California. So we have to default back to them because who else are we going to go to?
Yeah, right.
And so we are, you know, but at the same time, we're also, just because another lake is doing something doesn't mean we do it. So that kind of makes us nervous as well. Where we have gone is Fish and Game has set some parameters for decontamination and for inspection of boats. We've set ourselves above that to make sure that we're okay. Now, there's a lot of places that have set themselves far below that. And until we can be guaranteed that that's not going to happen. And all we're trying to do is to keep our, and you know, Pete Jenny, my boss, our division manager, who is now the deputy director of parks, went before the San Luis Obispo City Council and had this same sort of in the same sort of thing. Of course, they were doing it at midnight, but you know, he had some. There were some issues that came up that were very, you know, that they were very concerned about, and he went through the same presentation and explained what we're doing, and they seemed, you know, satisfied but want to continue to monitor the situation. I wish that there were more leadership and more cooperation amongst some of our state agencies. I mean, I think barcoding would be a great idea. It's going to be expensive, but not as expensive as it could be by the time this thing goes down the road. Barcoding, quarantining the existing lakes and telling people that they have to clean the boats before they leave. Now, they're recommending that they do, but, you know, somebody, you pull your boat out of the water, somebody says you should clean your boat. Well,
most people just take, if they're local, they just take their boat home and wash it.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, that really concerns me about boats that are traveling. And I know that the agricultural inspection station catches a lot of boats coming from the Colorado River, which is infected, and Lake Havasu. But they'll catch those boats when they're coming across, you know, coming across on 15 or whatever the other one is down there. I can't remember, down in the desert. But what about the boats that are coming up 5 from San Diego? You know, sure, they're setting dry for a number of days, but that doesn't make any guarantees. And why aren't they, why isn't Metropolitan Water District, you know, quarantining some of their lakes? They're allowing boats, I think, to go back and forth. And now what's funny is this could all be changing while I'm talking right now, and has. There are things that are happening on a day-to-day basis. I follow it all the time to watch what happens, not just, you know, through the fishing community, through the bass club community, through the water purveyor community. And I'm sure that this is just going to be an ongoing issue. Like I said, it's spreading, going northward. I know that Santa Clara County just closed all of their lakes. Now, most of their lakes, a lot of their lakes are smaller, and some don't even allow motorboats. I know that the lake that has zebra mussels, San Justo, they don't allow motorized boats on that lake. They're still trying to figure out how they got zebra mussels there. But
I guess the other thing is that I can see this when the real boating season starts out there, you're going to be
we'll have our
answer. More people and
yeah.
And of course, getting more people is more money, and so it would seem to me that a rate schedule or something. Mm-hmm. Cover this out of
yeah, I really, necessary. We probably won't see anything until next year, until we do our rollover and we go through our fee, you know, our fee schedule, which we do once a year. I could definitely see the fees going up. And I mean, I don't think people would really, I mean, boy, I'd probably get stoned by a million boaters if I told them this. But, you know, even something at the state level where the registrations on boats went up a little bit to pay for this, mm-hmm. you know, overall, so that the state could get mobilized and make some sort of a database system where people know where they have been, where this boat has been, and where it's, what lakes it's traveled in. And, you know, the perception, part of the perception on the public's part is that we're out at the lake and we're spraying mussels off of boats.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my next question. Yeah. I was told when I suggested that they mm-hmm. steam these boats mm-hmm. that the water was just going back into the mm-hmm. back into the lake.
No, that's
and so You're assuring me that
the water
is either being recycled.
Right. What it's doing right now it's going into the sewer system where it can't survive, and it's very small amount of water that we're using there because it's a pressure washer that's putting out. You know, it's more the heat that's blasting them. The first week that we were in operation, we set up a kind of an environmental sump because we had no place else to do with the water until we got our station completed. So we made sure that area was all contained in an area where there was plenty of biofilter where it wouldn't make it down to the lake and it just dried out. But now, of course, we're in a situation where we've got it contained and the water is all going into the sewer system.
Thanks. Those are the good answers and a lot of questions. I'm concerned about this.
And, you know, again, if there's any questions that you have, or you have any of your constituents have questions, please feel free to, you know, go through Dean to get a hold of me. I have a lot more knowledge on this than I ever thought that I would have or really wanted to have, but it's kind of piqued a level of interest in me where I'm really looking at what's going on at the state level and the federal level as well. So I really do understand the financial and the, you know, the implications for, you know, your body and for what you guys do. And I know that even the board of supervisors does as well, because just because one boater's upset, there are 50 or 60,000 water users that are relying on us to make sure that, you know, to give them assurances that this is not, you know, that we're not just allowing people to come into the lake that are bringing dirty boats in.
Is there any way that we could help you advertise this within the community? Like, you know, every 2 weeks we have a TV show here that... Channel 20.
Right. You know, and I've thought of that, and it's something that, you know, education and educational outreach is great. I wish we were able to do more of it, and it's something that I enjoy doing and, you know, getting out the message and public service announcements or whatever it might be. Unfortunately, I've been so wrapped up on the regulatory part of it, I haven't really had a chance to do that. And I believe that outreach is probably one of the most important things, because we certainly get a lot of people that show up and say, you know, we didn't know anything about this. You should have put this in the paper. Well, we did, but they only tell what as much as they're going to give you. You know, they're going to be interested in quagga mussels as long as they think it's going to make a big story. I don't know how many of you have seen the big sign that we've got out at Tally now that says quagga mussel alert. You know, your boat must be clean and dry, that sort of thing. I mean, I wish I could put one on 101, but I can only go so far. I guess we could hire a biplane maybe and have them tow something behind it. But yeah, any suggestions or ideas that anyone has, please feel free to contact me. I think all of you know how to get a hold of me, and I'd be happy to either answer questions or you can refer, you know, constituents to me. A big issue is the wakeboard community. It doesn't make up for a tremendous amount of our use, but there are some individuals that are quite concerned that they're not going to be able to get their, you know, their boats that they spent a lot of money on the water. But at this point, until we have a decontamination system that can take care of that internal ballast system, we're just not going to let them on, because a lot of those boats go to the Colorado River and then they come here. And I can't see inside that ballast. I don't know what's growing in there. And until we know that we can effectively remove it or decontaminate it, we just don't want to do anything with them. So we just have to turn them down. It's going to be interesting this weekend. I imagine we'll probably have to turn away, well, maybe 20. It's our rejection rate's been about between 5% and 10%. So it's not that many. Most people that come in, they got their tag. They're ready to come in. That's the bulk of people. And the rest of them are coming in with clean boats and they're dry. There are a few people that come in that just don't have a clue. And I mean, we had a guy show up and he was coming from, what was the lake? Lake Isabella. And his entire live well was half full. His live well was half full of green water. And he seemed to think that he could just spill it out in the parking lot and he'd be okay to go on the lake. And we just said, no, you've got to take that and your water and take it out. And you can't come back today. You can't come back until you're clean and dry. And even though it wasn't an infected lake, it's probably something we should have been thinking about and doing 20 years ago. Because, you know, this is people's drinking water and you're bringing in substances on boats. So, you know, in a way, it's a sign of things to come. You know, we've got New Zealand mud snails out there. We've got zebra mussels and quagga mussels and hydrilla. And there's a number of other invasive species that we have to worry about as well. This is just another one of them.
More questions from the right side of the bench. John?
They've all been answered. Thank you.
No? One more. Don, has there been any discussion at the state level to prevent this from getting into the state water project, because we're going to be a beneficiary or a recipient of that at some point in time.
I think that, you know, I haven't been able to follow that end. Doug, do you have an answer for that?
Yes, if I may, Mr. Runnels, Mr. Gehring. Department of Water Resources actually developed over the last year or so a technical report of some 60 to 70 pages on quagga mussels and what efforts can be taken to keep them out of the state water project. And it was actually quite a detailed study, right down to the minutiae for the biological aspects of the organism and how they managed to get from here to there. So they have been looking at it very closely.
Thank you.
Mr. Ash.
I know, so everything we seem to be talking about is about prevention, but as we've seen, that they seem to get in some places despite all the preventive measures you incorporate there. So at some point, we're going to have to also be talking about what do you do for maintenance, and once they arrive in that, and there I can see where the big costly figure is, because I don't think this county has a where-to-alls as far as the finances to back it up there. One other point there, I was talking to an old-timer the other day there, and I brought this up at the last RAC meeting, I guess it was last week there. He was telling me about back in the 50s, I believe it was Union Oil at the time, the oil companies down in Santa Maria, they had this pipeline that brings the oil on up, and they followed the old right-of-ways of the whatever the train was called back then, and they go through Los Barrios, and they came through Grover Beach and went on up to Avila and out on the station road and everything, and then went further north. Well, they employed him and a couple others, and they spent 2 years on the project, and they followed the pipelines, steel pipelines, like much like that you bring your water in, and they about every 2 miles they dug down and they attached a system, a battery-operated system there that prevents electrolysis. It puts a mild charge in the lines there, and they've been in existence for a long time. Then he brought up the fact that the shipping industry out there, and I believe even our naval ships in that, employ a mild charge in the bilge tanks to prevent mullets and mussels from attaching to the ships. So we were thinking there, why can't a system like that be employed on your steel pipelines coming out of the lake, because you're worried about them infestating the your actual million-dollar plant out there? Why can't we employ a low-level deal? And Pablo, at the time at the meeting, he indicated he assigned one of the parties, I guess, one of his engineer types up there to look into it there. But I think we also need to be looking at what happens when they arrive, because I hear a lot of not so much positive, more negative, because they feel it's inevitable that they're going to be coming to us there, and then that means it's going to shift to a different mode, I believe.
Absolutely, and that's where the part where I was talking about where this needs to be a concerted effort, where it rather than to say, well, it's recreation, that everyone's going to need to be concerned about this and look at this in kind of a whole, as the whole pie. And I went to a training in Ventura a few weeks ago and talked with a couple of a biologist and a scientist who had come out to show some of the work that they had done in the Great Lakes. And obviously, there's a tremendous amount of work that's already been done. It's just not readily available. And I think that you're talking about people are going to want money for how they're getting rid of them. There's everything. There are oxidizing agents that can be used. There are the stuff that's been used in drinking water before. There's you know, taking off intakes, and I know that at least a lot of the Nacimiento Water Project is being you know, constructed. John Hollenbeck is making sure that there are methods in place that will deal with this. Now, we don't have that luxury, of course, at our treatment facility and our intakes, but there are. It's not game over. I mean, once you get them, it certainly isn't. It's just, and not only that, but you have no idea what the rate of spread is going to be. It's certainly not favorable. You really don't want it to happen. But once it does, there are. It's been dealt with before, and there are you know, a number of methods that I've been looking at and saying. Of course, I'm not in the engineering business, but. The methods are out there. There are different types of Teflon that they've worked with. They've worked with silicone. They've worked with, I believe they've even worked with electricity. So there the options are there. But I like what you're saying, because it does, it shows that we're looking at this in a 360 degree way, instead of saying, well, this is the only way. Now we've got to look at what might happen 20 years down the road. So, any more questions at all?
Don, I have a couple.
Okay.
The first one would be have you found any quagga mussels on any boats in all of your efforts to date?
No, and not at all. And that's where I kind of go back to that, is the media, KSBY, was talking about that we were spraying the mussels off the boats. And it almost gave the impression that, you walk across the parking lot and you're crunching on mussel shells as you walk across. And I the only mussel that I've seen has been in a plastic container that I brought back from the training. And that's it. So we have not found a mussel yet.
The cost of the operations that you're continuing with to date,
mm-hmm.
that's coming out of parks?
That's correct, yes.
One thing I want the committee to think about is, if we get an infestation, I'm having a hard time figuring out why the water supply end of things should support the cost of remediation.
Good point.
In other words, if we get an infestation, unless someone can straighten me out and I'm wrong, it seems to me it's going to come from recreation, nothing that water supply is doing.
Go ahead.
I was going to say the reservoir, of course, is funded by recreational grant funds. So there is a linkage there that, to some degree, that says that, that the project and the reservoir addresses both uses. But unfortunately, the mussels primarily affect the water supply function, the clogging of the valves and so forth. So mm-hmm. there's maybe a linkage, but I really think the efforts that Don and his folks are doing are the thing that we really need to emphasize, and with strict controls on prevention. But like you said, when we do mm-hmm. get it, we have to figure out,
right,
and maybe you've already figured that out, where we're mm-hmm. going on how to control mm-hmm. the mussels once it does happen. Mm-hmm. Because it seems inevitable that in some time, the next however many years, that we're mm-hmm. going to get them.
It seems to me that it'd be unwise to relax the strict protocol that we have going presently.
I agree.
So are you getting any pressure from any sector to do that?
No. No, not at all. And, if we were to get it, it would be from our water purveyors, and I don't look to have that happen at all. I know that there are some people, there's kind of a movement afoot that are trying to categorize this as being a swine flu kind of epidemic, something that is just, what we're doing is not worthwhile. I know that some of the board members have been contacted and told that, this is kind of hysteria, and it's a way to make more money, and if they have information that could tell me that this is not serious, I'd like to see them share it with the city of San Luis Obispo and with the Zone 3 Advisory Board, because there's nothing that tells me to relax, or nothing that tells me that not to take this seriously. So,
do you need any sort of action on the part of this committee to support you on maintaining the strict protocol that you have going now?
And not at this time, other than there's a chance that you could hear from your constituents, some of the fishermen and some of the wakeboarders or the recreational community, that may come to you and complain that this is a cumbersome process, and maybe that their boat was turned away or something. And I can assure you that it is being done and applied fairly, that no one's skating on it. Everyone is being required to do the same thing. As we learn new information, things like canoes that are brought in on top of a vehicle and they're upside down, decontaminating a clean and dry canoe really doesn't make much sense. We're still doing it right now, but that's maybe something down the road that we may not do anymore, because it's traveled however far it's traveled. It's upside down and has nothing in it. We're trying again. I keep emphasizing focused and practical inspections. If we're going to go through this process, I want it to do some good. I don't want to be wasting our time. I don't want to waste the boaters' time. But at the same time, I want to be making the most out of our resources and making sure that that's what we're doing is seeking out and finding any evidence of the veligers or the mussels at all.
Just one last comment. It would seem prudent. Maybe, Doug, you've already done it, that we go through a scenario that, yes, we will have the mussels at some point in time. What is Public Works looking at in terms of what part of our facilities would be most affected and what would we do about it at that time?
Thank you, John. Actually, I do have a report to give on what Public Works is doing. It was going to be part of the operations report, but if you will, I think this would be the appropriate time.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay. As Don said, there was a summit that was held over in county offices several weeks ago, and in addition to the park staff, a number of Public Works Department staff were there, staff from the city of San Luis Obispo, and some representatives from Fish and Game, who provided a presentation and discussed the quagga mussel issue. One of the things that we've found, or one of the things that we've learned, is that you know, these have been around for quite a while back east, and states that don't take a proactive approach to dealing with this problem end up suffering considerably. Wisconsin, in fact, was very proactive, did a lot of public information work, and were able to keep the quagga mussels down to a minimum. Adjoining states didn't take the same approach, and now they're having some real issues, both for recreational facilities and for drinking water supplies. I'm just going to briefly run through a few things that we've got going for efforts right now. As you're all aware, the county operates Salinas Dam, Santa Margarita Lake, and the water in that reservoir belongs to the city of San Luis Obispo, or they have the water right to it. The city recently called us and asked that we set aside $50,000 for quagga mussel, zebra mussel analysis and studies, which has been done by our accounting staff. We worked the budget together with them. In addition, Gary Henderson at the city indicated to us that the city has hired a biologist, and they wish to work very closely with the county on this issue because it's in both of our best interests. The other thing is, as you're aware, the Nacimiento project is currently under construction. And Don mentioned that John Hollenbeck, who's the project manager, has been looking at this. I've been attending the Nacimiento Technical Support Group meetings, which is equivalent to your TAC. And what we're looking at now is changing or modifying the fish screens that were going to be installed on the intake. Originally, they were designed to have 24 bolts to hold them on to the intake, and what they're doing is they've reduced that to 4 bolts. Makes it a little quicker and easier to get it off. The other thing is they will have a second set of screens on site out of the water so that in the event we do get clogging of the screens, that they can be replaced, taken out. One set can be taken out, the new set can be put in, and the infested set can be cleaned. We're also including injection points on the pipeline so that we can superchlorinate or add whatever other chemical may be deemed appropriate for killing off the quagga mussels if they start infesting the pipeline. And the last thing is that it's being designed to have capability for pigging so it can receive and remove pigs for cleaning, and also there'll be discharge areas for discharging all of the water so that it doesn't run back into a water body. That, of course, is one of the biggest concerns. Nacimiento, the other thing with that is that, as Don mentioned, there are any number of accesses to Nacimiento, and one of the things that the commission and the TSG are trying to determine right now is how to control that. And there are only a couple of major roads that go into Nacimiento, and then they split up, and you've got ways for people to get in. So there's even looking at maybe having inspection sites on those major roads and inspecting all the boats going in. Okay, as for Lopez Lake in Zone 3, after considerable discussion at management level, Pavo Ogren, Glenn Pretty, Dean Benedicts, and others in the department, the decision was made to take $50,000 from the Zone 3 reserves, which is already there, so it doesn't mean it's an increase in your rates or anything, but to take $50,000 out of the reserve and put it into the operating budget for mussel studies and prevention efforts for Flood Control Zone 3. As I indicated before, prevention is one of the major things that can be done. The other is now Don indicated that they're looking at doing some sampling. We're also doing that on Nacimiento right now. our staff is working with Monterey County Water Resources Agency, Fish and Game, to do sampling in Lake Nacimiento, and we would like to be working with Fish and Game and with Don's Parks organization. We were very pleased. I think everybody on the public works staff was very pleased with the approach that County Parks is taking to this and the very strong effort that they're making to ensure that we don't have contamination in either one of our two reservoirs, Margarita or Lopez. And we want to be part of that effort. We feel that we need to be part of the effort. If we're not, the cost to the Lopez project could be tremendous. Some of you may recall that we have any number of intakes on Lopez Reservoir, and those are all screened, and I'm not sure that they were designed to be removed. If they get clogged up with mussels, it may be a matter of sending a diver down to just dislodge them. I'm not sure. We haven't really gotten that far into looking at it, but basically that's my report. If you have any questions.
Just one, Doug. I think Ted mentioned cathodic protection type of currents on the screens and whether that is an effective way to reduce the potential for the mussels to attach themselves to the screens.
The DWR report that I mentioned earlier did discuss a number of things, including electricity, the use of copper bands. Copper apparently has some sort of an electrical current. I think it works on slugs and snails in your yard, supposedly. The use of various types of poisons. Unfortunately, to put enough poison into a lake to kill them off, you're going to kill everything else off. They look at everything down to completely draining out the water and leaving it dry for a period of time to try to control them. So all of those things are being looked at, and we need to be looking at it also and see what's going to be most appropriate and what's going to be the most efficient and affordable for our operations.
Doug, so to paraphrase what this $50,000 is likely to do for us is maybe an infestation response plan and maybe an early warning system so we are able to deal with infestation of the intakes before it restricts water supply.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Anybody else have any questions? Any more questions on the quagga mussel thing? Mr. Reynolds.
One thought, Mr. Chairman. Doug, since San Luis Obispo is going to study this also, are we going to do it in parallel with them, or is it going to be completely different direction?
I think it's be to all of our advantage to do it in parallel, mm-hmm. and I think we will attempt to do that as much as possible, okay. Just as we are with County Parks.
Thank you.
Would you be more comfortable with any kind of an action from this committee regarding allocation of the $50,000?
Well, as I said, the decision was made by county staff to take the money out of reserves, but your council's endorsement of that action would be greatly appreciated.
What does everybody think? Seemed like it was a really good idea to me to be out ahead of the curve, and county staff is responded admirably. So shall we endorse the actions to date?
I make a motion that we endorse the action of taking $50,000 out of the reserve for a study concerning the mussel.
I'll second that.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Carries unanimously.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Anyone have anything else on the quagga mussel issue? Ron Coleman in the Hawaiian shirt. I think you're up for the rest of the operations report.
This is casual Thursday.
Oh, me, yes.
Okay, good evening, members. I'm Ron Coleman. I'm the, can everybody hear me okay? The superintendent for the South County operations, which includes the Lopez Water Treatment Plant. And Dean's not here, obviously, so he asked me to give this part of the operations report that has to do with the Lopez Lake, the terminal reservoir, and the water plant itself. So that's what I'm here to do. So we'll start with Lopez Lake. The elevation, today's elevation was 507.25. That's a storage capacity of 36,500 acre feet and 74%, pardon me. Downstream releases are 4.0 MGD. Rainfall to date was 16.83 inches. I could say, too, on the quagga mussel issue and cathodic protection, we have cathodic protection on that section of line, induced current. We have the rectifier at Biddle Park, and it goes up as far as the outlet building. And that's where it's isolated and ends there. So that's just a little tidbit of information. The terminal reservoir itself, we've actually been dealing with some elevated odors and fluctuating algae counts the last about 3 weeks or so, which have given us some odor issues. What we've done to correct the issue so far to date is we've treated the terminal a few times with our standard algicide. Started a few treatment processes. We started up the activated carbon system to adsorb the taste and odor particles. We've also started up the potassium permanganate and added some chlorine at the influent there to try to oxidize some of the taste and odor particles. It's going to be it's that time of the year where it's probably going to be an ongoing issue through the summer months, so we're going to have to stay on top of that one with our chemical feeds, mostly our activated carbon. That's the best choice treatment process to control it. The water treatment plant itself, the individual treatment processes have been functioning quite well. Currently, the production through the plant is 4.5 million gallons a day. The turbidity levels leaving the plant of 0.01 or less, which is quite good. State water deliveries at this time are 1.8 million gallons a day. And that's basically the very basic mini report on those three aspects of Lopez. So any questions on any of that?
Questions? Any burning questions?
I don't know. Ron, how are the control systems working? I know that we've been through
The SCADA system?
Yeah.
The SCADA system, they've made some improvements to it, and it's functioning well. They're still working on a few things, some automatic shutdowns, they're getting close to programming the automatic shutdowns for some critical power failures. If we don't meet CT values, if we've got problems with that. So that should be the next few weeks or so, but... The SCADA system has been working fairly well. It's nice. It's nice to have that system compared to what we had before there.
So, Ron, the flow rates through the plant are smoothed up considerably, and the feed rates are pretty smooth now compared to earlier in the year?
Well, they've made some adjustments to the front end of the plant as far as the flow rates and how it coordinates with the back end. Craig and the programmers... Mike Graber, I believe, is his name. They've worked on a few things, and it smoothed it out quite a bit.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr.
Earing.
Looking at this operations report, I might not have heard right. Did you say that the rainfall was 16.83 inches?
To date, yeah. Yes.
To date?
Yes. I went on the county site just to see what it was for the year, and that's what they had on there.
That's through this particular date right now.
Correct.
I mean, there says 13.04 on report, but that was, I guess, through April.
Yes, that's my year. That's actually for the calendar year on there, and I should have had for the rain year on there. So it's 16.
Okay.
16.83 for the rain year, which is July 1st. It starts.
So really, we're not that far behind, are we? Was it about 19?
I think we're.
Where is that gauge, Mr. Coleman?
The is that the dam itself? and it's a new electronic tied into the not the SCADA system, but the networking system. So it's not something that we read all the time. It's just it's constantly picking up the data and automatically downloading it.
Mr. Ehring, from my perspective, we're still below the average for a normal year by perhaps 15%.
Okay. Yeah, we are below. I don't think we're going to get any more this year, but we started out great, but it kind of tapered off a little bit.
Mr. Wallace.
Ron, I just keep getting confused on our year-to-date statement, whether it's year-to-date calendar or year-to-date water year.
What you have there is calendar. That was just to kind of get you caught up for this year on some totals. I'm still working on the water year back zone 3, the monthly reports, getting them all caught up.
Okay.
But that there is just information for this calendar year to get you some summaries on what the deliveries were for Zone 3 contractors.
And appreciate it. Maybe if on these reports, if you could indicate whether it's a calendar year to date or a water year to date for the various reports, it would be helpful.
Right. That's a good point. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Coleman? Seeing none, thank you for your report. And
You're welcome.
The way, Mr. Mellon, thank you for your staff report, too. Before we completely leave that subject, Mr. Byrd, I've noticed in trying to access the County Public Works website on water resources and particularly rain gauge information throughout the county that many of the gauges seem to be stopping, at least the results that are presented, seems to stop 2003-2004. And I don't know if I'm misaddressing the system or they just haven't been updated. I'm wondering if that could be found out.
I wasn't aware that there was an issue. I will discuss it with our staff tomorrow when I get back into the office. You know, this last rain season, we were checking the rain gauges and the stream gauges on a regular basis and partly for, you know, the trimming back on the releases from the reservoir during the month of January, and I know we had the records then, so let me check with our staff and see what's going on. And that's with the rain gauges in particular?
It'd be the rainfall information throughout the county. For instance, there are gauges in Atascadero, Paso Robles, Morro Bay. I don't seem to find any of those that are presented past 2003-2004.
I could probably go to the computer and pull it up for us right now.
He could. All right. Anything else on operations report before we leave that item? Seeing none, it looks like we're on to old business and plant upgrade update. And Mr. Byrd, I think that's you, if you have more on that subject.
Yes, I do. Okay. Plant upgrade. Kennedy Jenks has developed a draft audit report, and that has been under review by public works staff, including our operations personnel. A request has been made to Kennedy Jenks to provide cost information associated with their recommendations. And once we have that cost information, both the draft report and the cost information will be provided to your technical advisory committee as soon as we have it in hand. I don't know at this time when we would expect to see it, but I would imagine it would be in fairly short order. On the next item for the upgrade, the one-year warranty inspection is currently underway this month, so we're going through and checking everything on the upgrade, making sure everything's going to be functional. On the state revolving fund loan for the upgrade, a request is going to be submitted to the state requesting a two-year extension for us to enable us to complete the identified remedial projects. The request does not include any request for additional funds. So it's we're still going with the original $26 million that was approved. But we do, I believe Dean was able to find that there was a way for us to legitimately go to the state and request an extension on the SRF contract, and so that's in process right now. So, and that would be for a 2-year term, which should allow us to get all the additional projects completed. Work on the sludge beds has been completed, and I'm not too up on the details of that. If you need details on that, I'm sure Ron could help out with that. I understand that there's been a reduction in the use of citric acid, and one of the recommendations for the plant was to install a new water softening system, and that's going to proceed, and then once that's up and running and operational, then the PUL performance test will be conducted, and that's a 42-day test of the facility. So, again, I don't have much on the detail, but at least this gives you an idea of where we are with that. And that's all the notes I have for the upgrade.
Questions for Mr. Bird on the upgrade issue?
Just one. Doug, what's the purpose of the extension for the revolving fund loan? If we don't need any additional money, it's just the time required to finish all the improvements that is required by the terms of the contract?
Well, I think you're aware that there were a number of issues with the project and that Kennedy Jinks was brought in to look at what had been done and make recommendations on what needs to be done to rectify some of the issues there. And so that's what the extension is for. We need the additional time to get everything done. But my understanding is because of, you know, the cost of the project didn't come up to the $26 million. It's a couple million less than that, I believe. Then we have, and frankly, I don't know exactly where the costs are. Jennifer may know. But we have sufficient money available to get those remedial projects done and apply it all to the state revolving fund loan.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Bird, actually, this maybe Ron can better help me on this. I'm curious that we're still having an issue with regard to sludge generation. Has that been solved? I noticed in the last minutes that there was an issue with sludge generation, and are we on track now with regard to that issue?
Yeah, you should, because it's being recorded, I think.
I lost my
The sludge beds have been an issue at the plant for a number of years, because we only have two, and they've been needed to be upgraded even before the upgrade. But the extra chemical usage and sludge generation, well, that's happened the last 2 or 3 months, put an overload on our sludge beds. It's been backed off probably the last month. The cleaning of the membranes don't take as much chemicals any longer. It's only one part now instead of a two part. So it has eased up on what's going down in the sludge beds. So we're able to handle it better, but we still have that issue, long-term issue, if that makes any sense.
Well, that makes sense. And then the next question on that subject is the brine from the water softener. Is that going to be an issue?
You know, I'm not sure about the water softening process. I don't have much info on that, of exactly where that process would be implemented or installed or how that would work. So I can't answer anything on that yet.
Well, maybe that's something Mr. Benedix can bring back to us next time.
I'll make a note of it, yes.
I'm a little concerned that we're at the 1-year warranty inspection stage and we haven't done a 42-day performance test on Paul. That seems like a conflict to me. Are we out ahead of ourselves on that, or Is that not a conflict for some reason?
Frankly, I'm not sure, but I think we're in good hands with Dean overseeing it, but I'd have to check with him on that.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from anyone on that subject? I think we are to Jennifer Colvard for the third quarter budget status update.
Jennifer Colvard, Public Works Department. The first item, not as tall as Ron.
You're on.
Okay. The first item tonight is the third quarter budget status report for Zone 3. Please refer to the graph in the handout section 3-1, and I think you're pretty familiar with these graphs by now. The first graph at the top is capital outlay and reserves. We're currently under budget by roughly $785,000. This is primarily due to the perimeter fencing and waterline bridge projects. The second graph represents operations and maintenance, and there's an increase in costs over budget by netting around $634,000. Primarily, this is due to the water treatment costs being over budget by $824,000 to date, with some smaller savings in some of the other categories. $504,000 of this increase is due to increased labor costs, $300,000 is due to increased chemicals and utilities, and $20,000 is due to water quality lab analysis and support. The third graph compares non-routine operations and maintenance. The costs are currently under budget, $324,000, and this is due to the pigging projects and HCP water projects, or water rights, excuse me. While we make our best effort to budget accurately, obviously, you know, there are certain variables that we cannot predict. With the increased water treatment plant costs, even with the increase in the water treatment plant costs, total budget's currently 16% under budget. This is mostly due to the unspent capital outlay. Again, we need to keep in mind how to handle the increased O&M costs. At the year end, when the costs have settled and we know exactly how much over budget the O&M costs are, we'll need to either rebudget for the capital outlay costs for in future budgets. And again, this kind of ties into the SRF loan extension, too. We are trying to maximize the $26 million. And the way that the contract was written, we thought the state keeps these guidelines of 3 years for the SRF loans. When we pursued that a little bit more, the state actually has a five-year requirement. So there's a two-year leeway. They stick with the three. I think they try to keep the SRF loans within the 3 years with the exceptions. And really what we're trying to do is just, I think there's $1.4 million that we haven't utilized of the $26 million. So if we can extend it the additional 2 years, it gives us more time to get those costs in rather than having to budget them in the Zone 3 budget. Again, remember that we did return a fairly large credit in the 0607 final billings in December. At the prior meeting, we were asked to provide more details showing the budget to actual cost to date for 0708. So if you look at the attachment 3-3, this is all the detail that backs up those three charts that I just discussed with you. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them, but if you have any questions on those after I'm done, feel free to ask me any questions. These are just all the details, and if you look at them, if you look at the table, it's broken out by capital outlay, non-routine, and routine O&M, and this does correlate to how the budget book presents the costs, the itemization of the costs in the budget book. And this kind of, I guess I'll go ahead and get to the second item, which relates to the five-year billing estimate. I will be emailing out the revised five-year billing estimates tomorrow to the Finance Committee, the TAC Committee members, and also the Advisory Committee members. In the meantime, I'm going to give you a quick overview. Now, attachment 3-4 didn't quite come out, so I printed out some copies so you can get a better look at that.
Get one of these.
So you need three of these down there.
Yeah. One. Guys. One my way.
And one your way.
Yeah.
Here, here's one. Here.
All right. Whoever. All right.
We
I'll take
that.
These.
Okay.
These.
You got to.
So there should just be the two handouts. Does everybody have a copy?
Okay. We all got. We got these.
Yeah.
So the first one. It's a comparison of the five-year estimates. It's the long bar graph. And basically what this is we've been doing the five-year billing estimates, I think, for about 5 years now. And this is just a quick comparison of the different budget estimates for each budget year in the past 5 years that we've presented them to you. So if you look at the first group, budget estimate for 08-09, you'll see what the what we've estimated for the budget year 08-09 since March of 2004. And you can see in the second and third, which would be, I guess I don't even know what colors those are, rust color and yellow, that we were actually budgeted much higher than what our final budget for 08-09 ended up being. And then if you look at the second group for the budget estimate for 9-10, if you look at what the budget is, our current five-year estimate compared to the last estimate, you'll see that it actually went up about $840,000. And that leads into the second chart that I have provided for you. That's the makeup for that $840,000 difference. So you'll see the yellow and the blue down at the bottom make up the majority of that is, well, it's labor, increased labor costs. And this is just comparing the estimate that we provided you last year versus the estimate that we're providing you now. And then the other larger increases are the chemicals and utilities. So this just kind of gives you a better visual of why they've gone up. One more quick item to mention. We did recently receive a notice from Standard & Poor's. They've reviewed our underlying rating for the San Luis Obispo County Finance Authority Lopez Dam Improvement Bonds, and they've changed our rating from an A- to an A+. This doesn't mean anything for our current financing now, but it is good news if we decide to issue any future bonds. So this rating reflects the improved financial performance of Arroyo Grande and Pismo Beach, among several other factors. So this concludes my report. If you have any questions, I can answer them at this time.
Questions for Mrs. Colvard? Mr. Wallace, you always have a
question. No, I'm going to pass tonight.
I know I threw a lot at you tonight.
Jennifer, is that increase in rating due to an increase in valuation primarily or better payment? Record. Our payment record is perfect, right?
Sure. I'm sorry, I'm not quite understanding.
I'm curious about our rating increase.
Oh, the reason why the rating increase? I did bring the letter. It explains why the rate increase.
Oh, perhaps you could supply that to me.
I can actually email it. I can send an email this out to everybody.
That'll be helpful. Thank you.
There's quite a few reasons, so you'd probably rather just read it.
Any other questions?
I did have a question.
Mr. Wallace.
I can't let this go by. Jennifer, on the increase from the prior estimate on the color graph that you handed out, a significant portion, almost, I guess it's number two, biggest piece of it is the labor increased hours. And maybe Ron would speak to this, but it would seem like as we're going forward, in this next fiscal year, that would go down quite a bit because we have now hopefully adjusted most of the control systems there. We've eliminated a shift out there. We don't have a graveyard shift any longer. Would you expect this really to materialize in this amount, or would it go down from what you showed here?
Well, that is correct, but that's only the difference from our prior estimate. When we did the estimate this year, we were looking at, I believe, 16-hour shifts when we created the budget, and then we have an 5% increase per year that we factor in to estimate out the cost for the future 4 years. So you're correct that this isn't looking at actual costs. This is just based on what we predicted in our budget when we did the 07-08 budget versus how we calculated worst case scenario for 08-09 budget. Does that make sense? Or?
Well, I'm still lost a little bit. Is this saying that your current estimate?
This is worst case.
Pardon me?
This should be worst case.
But is this saying that this increase is what you're currently estimating compared to what you previously estimated?
That is correct.
In that case, if you're looking at it today, it would seem like that you would have. Well, I understand. Okay, so you didn't count for the extra hours last time.
In the prior year budget, okay, those weren't accounted for.
Got it.
Right?
Thanks.
If I might add, the labor increased hours, $216,000, that is based on the 16-hour operations, and it's my understanding that we're looking at what we can do to come back to a 12-hour operation, and if and when that happens, this, of course, would provide a reduction. I believe also the chemicals, as Jennifer indicated to me earlier today, as we continue with the optimization of the facility and take care of the remediation projects, we should expect that to also be reduced.
Okay, good. Thanks, Doug.
Anybody else? Does that generate any other questions from anybody on the budget issue? Seeing none, thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Mrs. Colvard. Mr. Byrd.
Mr. Gehring, we have two other items under budget to discuss with you. The first one is going to be presented by Mr. Coleman. It's in regarding the utility tractor that's currently in the approved budget for this fiscal year. And then the second one I'll address, and it's regarding the pontoon boat that we have up at Lopez Lake.
Party boat.
Okay, we have a utility tractor budgeted in this year's budget. It's a multi-purpose mid-size tractor that does a little bit of everything for us. And we were planning on it utilizing it also as a forklift, attachment with forklift to handle and move all of our chemical totes that we have for the upgrade. But we miscalculated, and the capacity of the utility tractor with the forklift attachment is underrated for the weight of the totes, the capacity for the, it's about 3,000 capacity on the forklift attachment, and the totes weigh anywhere from 3,400 to 4,400 pounds. So we have an issue there, and we looked at cost estimates for a forklift, 25 to 30,000, and our thinking was that we would utilize the funds that's in this year's budget for the utility vehicle to purchase a forklift, with the balance of the funds being carried over to next year and making up the difference for next year's budget for a utility vehicle. So,
if I might add, and Ron, you can probably give a better cost estimate or detail than I can, but what are we looking at on a monthly rate, monthly rental rate for a forklift right now?
We've been renting a forklift. It's been about $1,000 a month renting it because we need to have it on site all the time because the totes come and go at all different times, and we miscalculated on the weight, obviously, and I get to take credit for that. But it's something that it's an important piece of equipment because the totes are coming and going at all different times, and they weigh quite a bit more than we anticipated.
Right, and the rental cost of $1,000 a month, $12,000 a year, is part of what was factored into the decision to come back to your committee and recommend that instead of purchasing the utility vehicle, that we go ahead and get the forklift now and then come back to your committee in the future to budget a utility vehicle again. But.
Mr. Reynolds has a question.
Ron, talking about having a forklift on a tractor versus having a forklift by itself, is there, considering the overall length of a tractor with a forklift on, I assume you're going to have a backhoe in the back, would you have enough room to operate reasonably within the confines that you have now rather than just having a straight forklift?
Well, if if that mid-sized utility vehicle with the forklift attachments, if it would, I believe it's small enough where we could, it would be maneuverable enough, but it's just, it just can't lift it. It can't lift
the weight. Yeah, but I mean, in the spaces you're going in, is there enough room to maneuver it properly?
A forklift?
Yeah, the one on a tractor. Because you're going to be, versus a 10 or a 12-foot overall length with a tractor and all the attachments on it, you're going to be considerably longer than that.
Actually, I believe we're going the other way, Tom. The tractor is longer, and we can't use the tractor because it doesn't have the capacity to lift. The forklift would be a little bit shorter, so we can get in and out a lot easier.
We're talking about the same thing. We're just going out a different direction.
Yeah, okay.
Mr. Wallace.
What is the utility vehicle?
It's a John Deere 110. It's a TLB John Deere 110. It's just a mid-sized backhoe with attachments, loader, attachment for a flail mower, so we can do some mowing, just a little bit of everything. So we have no equipment, backhoes, mowers, anything at the plant. Whenever we need to do something, we have to either rent them or try to get them from one of our road yards or something. So, and this was a mid-sized, smaller vehicle, tractor, so that we could haul it without needing a commercial license. That was another issue, to kind of keep it small enough to where it's functional. We could actually do some work with it, but wouldn't need someone with a commercial license to haul it around.
Right. Okay, so the tractor you want to postpone till next
Correct.
Year and go with a forklift,
Correct.
Which is a dedicated forklift that can lift the totes.
Correct.
And what's the cost of the forklift?
It was estimated between $25,000 to $30,000.
And the tractor?
We budgeted $90,000 for it.
Okay. I have that tractor.
Yeah.
The trailer.
The only question I would have is, are these, first of all, assuming we endorse the forklift,
mm-hmm.
is that Zone 3's forklift?
It's about the only only place we'd use it is at the plant there.
We're not going to loan it to somebody else?
Not without your permission.
We're not going to rent it to Zone 1A?
I don't believe so, because I don't think we'd haul that thing around. It would pretty much stay right at the water treatment plant, and it would be used quite a bit there.
So it's our forklift, or will be our forklift. It'll stay at the plant for
Honest.
Our use.
As far as
and this is going to have small tires on it, not have big tires to run into muddy fields or whatnot.
Correct.
I'm going to paint it blue so we can find it.
Put a GPS on it.
Ron, I can't resist. I have a 110D John Deere with all the.
Oh, do you?
Yeah,
okay.
Exact same tractor you're looking at.
Okay.
It's great, but I think your cost is over what?
Well, that's a tractor, a trailer also to haul it.
Okay.
It was like $55,000 or something, and
right.
a trailer to haul it was, yeah, it wasn't 90 just for the
okay.
tractor.
Yeah, you scared me there.
No.
Yeah.
How do you like that?
It's great.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Yeah, that's what we thought, but yeah, we're still hoping.
And the tractor next year will be our tractor?
Oh, absolutely.
And not loaned out to Zone 1A or somebody?
Well, I don't believe so. I believe it would be Zone 3's tractor, and be nice to have a tractor.
We've heard this story before,
and,
right?
Yeah. I agree with Tom. You're not going to be able to turn that tractor around inside that building with forklifts and a backhoe on it. It would be, I think you're wiser to go with a forklift.
So, right.
A dedicated forklift.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Any other questions on that issue?
Forklift will save a lot of backs.
Yeah.
We need a motion on this?
So what do we need, Mr. Bird?
Your concurrence with the staff recommendation would be appreciated.
I shall move.
Second.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Unanimous.
Thank you, committee members. Appreciate it.
What, was that it, Mr. Bird, or did you have something else?
I have something else, yes. As you may be aware, up at Lopez Lake, we have a pontoon boat that probably predates my 24 years of service with the county, and I recall using it, in fact, years ago when I first started here. The pontoon boat is in a state of extreme disrepair at this point in time. The estimate right now for repairs is between $8,000 and $10,000. Purchase of a new boat with motor, depending on what size of motor we purchase and which type of motor, is anywhere between $18,000 and $20,000. This is not something that was put in the budget. This is something that, unfortunately, I think has just dilapidated over the years. The total package for getting a, and in fact, the other thing is it doesn't have a trailer. So what we're looking at in total is between $23,000 and $25,000 for replacement plus purchase of a trailer for carting this around. This is coming up mid-budget year, although we're rapidly getting to the close of that. The process for something that's not included in the current year's budget, and it wasn't included in next year's budget, it just happened to fall in between the cracks there, is that we come to your committee and ask for your endorsement. And provided we get that, then we have to go to the Board of Supervisors and ask for a mid-year budget adjustment. I have detail sheets here on the cost estimates from VS Marine, and I can get into more detail if you like. Basically, as you're aware, we do use that pontoon boat for treating the lake when we have high algae counts. Our operators also use it for conducting maintenance on the log boom and other facilities out there. So that concludes my staff report on that.
Questions for Mr. Bird? Yes, Mr. Costello.
So, Doug, this boat is a necessary piece of equipment. It's not something we can use something else to do these jobs.
I don't believe so. The operators put when they go to treat the algae, they put citric acid on it and copper sulfate, and I think it's in some quantity. We're talking 55-gallon drums of chemical, and then it has to be sprayed as you're driving the boat around. They set up a spray rig on it so that it's spraying out behind the boat as you're driving it around the areas where you've got the high algae counts.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Earring, I heard Mr. Mr. Earring, okay. You're next.
Okay. I guess my question is, I don't know this boat person that you're talking about. So local, this county, so we're going to get the sales tax on it?
The VS Marine?
Mm-hmm.
They're in Atascadero.
Okay.
Mr. Reynolds, I think.
Okay, now if this boat is going to be Zone 3 boat also, just like the tractor.
Yes, sir.
What do we need a trailer for then?
You have to haul it out occasionally to maintain it, I believe.
Okay, because the one that we got in there has never been out of the water for a while?
That I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, it would seem to me like if we're going to spend $10,000 to repair something that's 35 years old, that we'd be better off to start over. And so you had a new boat and a new motor and everything else, so it's up to date. And maybe we can get another 35 years out of this one.
Any other comments or a motion?
I move we authorize the, or we endorse the request of the board.
I'll second that.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Unanimous.
Pretty thank you very much.
We're glad you're back.
We need to ask tougher questions.
Yeah.
Is that the end of your items under budget, Mr. Byrd?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it is.
Okay, then you have a declaration of no surplus water. Is that what's next? I believe so.
Okay. And based on what information I've been able to obtain, we've pretty much used up everything on the safe field over the last water year. And so the process is now that we go to the Board of Supervisors with a formal staff report and declare and ask the board to declare that there was no surplus water from the last over the last water year, which ended end of the last month, or was it the end of end of March? Excuse me.
Questions for Mr. Byrd on that issue, Mr. Earing?
Yeah, I think I need a little bit more explanation. Okay, does that mean that the year ended in? If we're talking about a water year, what is the water year period?
The water year starts on April 1st, and it runs all the way through the year until May 30th, 31st, last day in May. March, excuse me. I don't have a calendar in front of me, so. Yeah.
Okay. So what you're saying is that although people did not ask for their full complement of water, that any excess that they didn't draw through that year, there is no more water. Is that what you're telling me?
I think I can give you a little brief, and Mr. Gehring is more of an expert on it than I am. But surplus water is generally the balance of water left over from. Okay, let me back up a little bit. The safe yield for the reservoir has two components. One of those is water that's delivered through the pipeline, which is 4,530 acre feet per year. The other component is water that's there for downstream releases into Arroyo Grande Creek, and that's 4,200 acre feet. So for a total of 4,730 acre feet.
87.
Thank you, sir. Surplus water is whatever water is left out of that 4,200 that's reserved for going into the creek for downstream releases. As you're all aware, for a number of years now, we've been conducting 4 million gallon a day releases day in, day out, year round, unless we need to increase the releases in the summertime for the ag users. At 4 million gallons a day, I think that equates to something like 4,700 acre feet. So we're over the 4,200 set aside for downstream releases, and in total, we've exceeded the safe yield on the project, so we don't have anything left that we can declare a surplus and be available for your agencies to use during the current calendar, current water year, excuse me.
The current water year that ended?
Normally what happens, Mr. Earing, is that at the end of a water year, staff will review the total amount of water that's been delivered through the pipeline and the total amount of water that's been released into the creek, add those two together, see if there's any balance left over, and if so, then a surplus can be declared for your agencies to take advantage of during this. In this case, if we declared there was a surplus and that you could purchase it, then it would be for the current water year, which began on April 1st.
Just
pretty clear.
To go back in time, back in the days when we controlled our downstream release to a point where we didn't let the water go past the 22nd Street Bridge in Oceano, in those days we regarded letting water go past that to be wasting water. Right. And in those days we often had surplus water, and I can recall surplus water values upwards of 900 acre feet. But until we get the amount of environmental release that we're currently conducting changed, we're not likely to have surplus water, I don't believe. Now, what about CSA 12, Mr. Wallace? Did you you didn't use all of your water over there, did you?
No, not yet.
Oh, not yet. Or did we release your...
It went down the creek.
Oh, it went down the creek.
It went down the creek for the fish.
We're close. We will be. We have 68.3, as you know, and I think we used 61 last year. So, yeah, it's close.
Well, basically, you're not going to have any surplus water until you get this fish deal taken care of and you have a spill, because, you know, we just, you're going to be letting out enough water to take care of that 8,700 acre feet just year after year, like we've been doing so far, I think.
I would agree with your assessment. Yes.
Well, we have our interim downstream release program in place. We have the monitoring in place necessary to operate the program. We just need a wet year to begin not releasing any more water than we have to, and perhaps at that point we might.
We can catch up on the remediation project.
Right.
We're down 58%.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm still going to stay on this.
Good.
Okay.
Ask away.
Okay. If we go and we look at the Lopez Dam operation chart we have, okay, in our packet. When we say that we got a storage of 36,828, what is the safe yield number for this lake?
48.
Pardon?
Well, the capacity is what, 48,000 acre feet now?
I think it's about
50, I think. Yeah. Okay, but the safe annual yield of the system, technically, has been accepted to be 8730 acre feet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And of that, 4530 is for municipal use, and 4200 is for downstream and agricultural use.
Okay.
And in the past, for instance, County Service Area 12 has something on the order of 340 acre feet.
Yeah.
Allocated to it. And in the past, much of that water was not being used, so that water, which was not requested or used, was available.
Mm-hmm. And we had like something like 1,100, and we only asked for 800 or something like that.
You talking about state water or Lopez?
I guess that's state water. Okay. Yeah. We don't have that much Lopez water. And I don't have that chart in front of me where you have the full schedule out as to what it is. It might be in here. Okay.
But, you know, there's ways to look at that if other agencies need the water. If, for example, with our state water, we're not taking any of our state water. We could take the state water and make the Lopez water available to other agencies, which might be a way to help out. And maybe for AVLA or CSA 12 to enjoy a little bit of reimbursement on that.
Certainly, and I think OCSD has been looking at that and discussing with Arroyo Grande.
Sure. Mm-hmm. For 200 acre feet, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else have any questions on that issue?
No. I'm going to stop until I get my charts out.
I think we're on to HCP processing status. Mr. Bird.
Yes, sir. Okay, as part of your staff report, on page 4-1, starting on page 4-1, is a letter from National Marine Fisheries Service to Pablo Ogren. And essentially, this letter is a response to a letter that we sent to them requesting that they provide us with some information as to the anticipated time frame for completion of the habitat conservation plan and continuation of monthly meetings. So now, I have a a little addition to this that we weren't able to get ready in time to get your staff report, but this was just completed yesterday, and what it is our response to this letter. So we're shooting letters back and forth, and I'd like to pass this out to you.
Great, please do. Okay, essentially, what this amounts to, the long and the short of it is that National Marine Fisheries Service and your staff, your Zone 3 staff, are in agreement that we need to continue working closely together to bring this to a reasonable and mutually satisfactory conclusion. And really, that's the gist of what we've got here in those letters, the letter that they sent to us and the response letter that we've sent to them. I think what I would like to discuss a little bit is the technical memorandum that was developed by Stetson Engineers on our behalf, and that's in relation to attraction flows and when and how we're going to conduct those. The original draft of the Habitat Conservation Plan proposed attraction flows without really without much regard for what type of a water year we were in, whether it was a dry year, normal year, or a wet year. What we have developed in our discussions, and this includes our fisheries biologist, Chuck Hansen, Curtis Lawler from Stetson Engineers, Mark Hutchinson from our Environmental Programs Division, and myself, and then with some oversight by Dean Benedict and Pavel Ogren, and discussing this with Anthony Spina from National Marine Fisheries Service, is that we have developed a system whereby we feel that we can reasonably assure that if we do conduct attraction flows for the fish, those are only going to happen in certain normal years and not in dry years. And we probably won't be conducting them in wet years because there will be sufficient flow in the creek. What we've done is we've developed a set of three triggers that would, once those triggers are met, would establish the necessary conditions for us to conduct attraction flows. The first of those is looking at inflow into Lopez Reservoir. Lopez Creek above the dam, it has a stream gauge on it that's maintained by USGS. And that stream gauge actually provides real-time data to their website, and it's available for us to utilize. So what we're proposing is that beginning on October 1st of any given year, we start tallying up how much water is flowing in to the reservoir through that creek from October 1st on. Anything prior to that, we don't look at. When we hit 3,600 acre feet, that's the line in the sand, if you will, or whatever. That's the point at which we have gone from a dry year to a wet year. If we never hit 3,600 acre feet going through that gauge, we're in a dry year, and that trigger never gets set. And so that's the first thing that we need to have is have the proper amount of inflow into the reservoir that indicates that we're into at least a normal year and out of the dry year. The second trigger would be the Arroyo Grande gauge station in the town of Arroyo Grande. And what we're looking at there would be the flow that's running through that gauge. And what we're setting as a minimum is 30 cubic feet per second. Anything less than that, and just because of the geomorphology of the creek,
the way it's constructed naturally and everything, you're not going to have sufficient flow in there for fish to travel upstream. So that's our second trigger. The third one is something we've discussed with your committee before, and that is a water level sensing station down near the lagoon where the flap gates are and the flood control channel. And this is only several hundred yards from the ocean, actually. And it would consist of a tower with a electronic real-time device on it that we can shoot to pick it up on our computers and on our, have it on our website, and a bubbler. And essentially what it does is it would monitor the level in the lagoon. And if we see a sudden drop in that water level in the lagoon, that indicates to us that the lagoon has breached the sandbar between the lagoon and the ocean, and that we've got flow going into the ocean. So that's our third trigger. Provided we have all three of those triggers, actually, those conditions met, we would then send somebody down to look at, and we'll have to develop specific criteria, but to measure the width and depth of the flow across the sandbar to determine if it's sufficient to allow fish passage. Provided that is there, what the proposal is to conduct fish passage flows, additional downstream releases, at the tail end of a storm event. Rather than, so if you look at it on a curve and through time, if your flow in the creek is coming up like this, you're going to have a point where it starts dropping off. And when it starts dropping off, down on that drop-off side, the backside of that flow is when we would go ahead and conduct the downstream releases and hopefully stretch out the period of time that there's sufficient water going across the sandbar for passage. So I think the main point of interest for us as county staff and for you as Zone 3 members is that by having this system with the three triggers and looking at what's happening with the flows across that sandbar, we reduce the amount of time, the number of times that we're actually putting additional water into the creek down to those times when it will actually do something for the fish. And in so doing, we effectively reduce the amount of times that we're putting water into the creek over what was originally proposed. So kind of wrapping it up right now, the Stetson report is in draft form. We county staff are all reviewing it. As soon as we've got it reviewed and shaped that we feel like all of our concerns have been met, we're planning on taking it to the Zone 3 Technical Advisory Committee for their review. And then once we get their review done and get their comments, we'll address those if we need to. And then what we're trying to get to is providing this to Anthony Spina from National Marine Fisheries and saying, here it is. This is our proposal. This is what we want to do. This is what we want you to include in your analysis. And what we're going to do is take the original draft HCP and take everything that we've put together with this and incorporate it into that. And hopefully at that point, we can go ahead and we can get off of this business with the downstream releases and the flow model and start getting through the analysis of the rest of the document. So our goal is to have this document, the technical report, to Mr. Spina within the next 3 to 4 months. So we're trying to get this moving just as quickly as we can. So, and then from that point on, they're indicating, you know, I think we're looking at maybe another year to get through the rest of it. We will have to bring back in U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Part of what the letter to Pavo indicated was that we haven't been dealing with them, and frankly, it hasn't been necessary for us to discuss it with them until we get this flow model business taken care of with National Marine Fisheries Service. That concludes my report. As always, I'm available for questions.
Mr. Reynolds.
Doug, has there been any discussion with these people about breaching the sandbar when we start to get some flow rather than have it run for half, three-quarters of a mile parallel to the beach so that we can take advantage of the water we're letting out instead of have it, you know, pool up there in a lagoon and maybe not go out at all?
Are you referring to mechanical breaching?
Absolutely.
We've discussed it, and there's not a person at the table that was willing to do that. And the part of the reason is because of the permitting issues. You have to go to the Coastal Commission now.
All right. But, you know, I could agree with that. But when you go down there to the beach and watch the state go down there and clean the sand out so they can drive on the beach with the cars, you know, looks like the cars are more important than the fish.
I don't have an answer for
that.
I'm just
philosophizing.
Telling you what I have observed, and they're doing it practically every day.
Yes, sir.
Those years ago, some guys used to do that and open it up so they wouldn't flood the fields. Anyway, but I don't think I'll be on this committee long enough to see this thing implemented. We've been working on it for 10 years already.
That's true.
That's all for me.
Mr. Ashton, anything? Questions?
Well, being fairly new on the board here, it seemed like at the last meeting we discussed that they've had this thing for, what, 4 years now? Now they're telling us that whatever they decide to look at it, it's going to take them 60 days. But how many more years is it going to take to get to that 60-day period?
Probably 2 more years.
How about the right side of the dais here? Anybody have any questions?
Doug, I have a question.
I'm just discouraged.
I got a question on trigger number 2. You said 30 CFS by the Roy Grande gauge. If you had more than 30, then that's what would enable the fish to swim upstream. And less than 30, they can't swim upstream.
Correct. Yeah, when you've got 30 CFS flowing through there, it's enough in certain areas above and below that to provide sufficient depth, and I think it's like 6/10 of a foot or a little bit, and I can't remember if they decided which way. It's something established by National Marine Fisheries, but there's, in any event, there's sufficient depth for the fish to swim up through there.
Well, to me, it's one thing that I took a strong exception to is one of the pieces of the letter basically saying the draft to HCP has been dragging, of course, the pace of which is largely applicant-driven. And it seems like a really missed, inappropriate comment. But it is what it is. And then on the other point about having to agree on this release program before they move on to other parts of the HCP seems to be just contrary to what we were talking about before, because there's a lot of other pieces in the HCP that aren't really affected by this release program. So why can't they proceed with reviewing the entire document while we're working in parallel on the release program?
That's been staff's concern also, and we feel that a lot of what's in the document helps support the, as we say in the letter, support the proposed model and the downstream release regime. Unfortunately, the National Marine Fisheries folks feel that it's more important to go ahead and get this settled out and then proceed from there. And frankly, as Mr. Ehring said, it is somewhat discouraging, but on the other hand, I think that we're getting closer and close enough that we can actually start bringing the other agencies back to the discussion table, as was suggested by them. And again, we're hoping to have the technical memorandum and the report finalized and to National Marine Fisheries within the next 3 to 4 months. As far as the 60-day business, that'll be interesting. Yes.
And we're still proceeding with the IDRIS on our interim release program?
Oh, definitely. Yes, yes. We've got, the, you know, all the gauges are in. The only thing that we have left to put in is that level monitoring station down in the lagoon. That may be of some value for the Idris also, but that's primarily for when we're actually looking at conducting attraction flows. And then I believe there was some discussion at your last meeting about whether or not there should be some cost sharing associated on that between Zone 3 and Zone 11A. And frankly, I haven't been that close to that part of it on the cost sharing side, and I'll be talking with Dean about it, but I would anticipate that there's going to be some sort of benefit to them. So.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Earing.
Do we know if any farmers, for example, can, you know, like throw a pump over there and just suck water out of the creek?
No, we know they can.
How do we know that?
We know they can.
No, yeah, that's what I'm saying. How do we know how much money, how much water they're pulling out of the creek?
It all goes with the riparian rights they have. Yeah.
If yeah, I might.
But they don't have the rights to pump water out of the creek. They have a right to drill a well and suck it out of the groundwater if that water is going back down there, but they don't have the right to throw a pump and suck water out of the creek. And I bet you tally up.
If the creek is running through your conjunctive with your property.
Not if it's a federal stream.
There's going to be a lot of people go to jail then because there's a lot of people pumping water out of the creek.
I know.
And it's been done like that forever.
Yeah,
that doesn't mean it's right and legal.
Well, it's a riparian right that goes along with it. Basically, the people who are fourth and fifth in line are the ones that have the prescriptive rights and the appropriative rights as far as water rights are concerned.
Yeah, but prescriptive rights, they can't establish how much water they pulled out most of the time. Most farmers can't tell you how much water they pulled out of a creek. They know how much water that they pulled out of their, you know, maybe out of their wells, which where they have gauges and things like that. But they're throwing this thing.
But in today's world,
I'll look into that.
But in today's world, the agriculture people are using far less water now than they did 10 years ago.
That's right.
With the technology, with the sprinklers and the drip irrigation. Yeah. So we could argue this for a long time.
Yeah, we could, Tom.
Mr. Byrd, going over your triggers, just to make sure I've got them straight. Okay, at the Lopez stream gauge, 3,600 acre feet, and it's wet enough.
Yes, 3,600 acre feet. The analysis that's in the staff report looks at what's the break point between a dry year, a normal year, and a wet year, and correlates that to flow through that stream gauge on Lopez Creek above Lopez Dam. And the 3,600 acre feet was that break point, so that once you get that amount of flow after October 1st of a given year, that's the break point for going from a dry year to a wet year.
All right, then further downstream at the Arroyo Grande gauge station, if you've got more than 30 CFS, I'm kind of wondering, it seems like operationally you'll probably want to set some upper limits. For instance, if it's going 90 CFS, we're probably not going to add to that.
We're definitely going to be looking at that also, yes.
And when do we plan to put in the sensing gauge at the lagoon?
It's really going to be dependent upon when we can actually make the purchase of the equipment, have it delivered, and have the staff time to have it installed. We have a couple of an engineer and an engineering tech that work in our office that handle all of our stream gauges and rain gauges, and so they're pretty well spread out, but they're quite good at what they do, and so we'll be working with them to get this in.
Right,
and if I may, that we want to get this in before the next rain season. Definitely. You know, I'd like to see it in by the end of September.
And you don't need anything from this committee for that action?
I don't believe so, no.
Didn't we approve those, all those gauges here a couple of years ago?
That's my understanding,
so.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Any questions? Rec area operations transfer, Mr. Byrd.
Yes, as you're aware, there are efforts underway to transfer the operation of the Lopez Recreation Area, and in particular the water and the wastewater systems, over to the Parks Department of County General Services. To date, there have been a number of staff meetings to discuss this and to kind of thrash out the details, if you will. At this point in time, we now expect the transfer to take place on July 1st of this year, which is also the start of the new fiscal year. The agreement for this transfer includes a 30-day cancellation clause by which either party to the agreement can cancel it. There is a condition, part of the agreement, that General Services will continue to operate the park area. And I believe that was discussed at your last meeting. And then FRM, the firm that we have hired to operate water and wastewater systems out at the rec area, will continue to do so. And that concludes my report.
Questions?
Does the 1st of July correspond with the sunset of the Davis-Grinsky money?
It's getting pretty close.
I think it's getting fairly close. I think it's this year. I know it's 2008, but I'm not sure exactly what the dating was.
Anybody else? Has the technical committee reviewed the agreement?
I don't believe that they have as yet.
But that's one of the things to be done, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
What is it that General Services is going to continue to run?
They're going to continue to run the park service, or the park out there. I think the concern was brought up at your last advisory meeting that perhaps the General Services might try to farm out the park operation to an independent contractor. And that didn't sit well with your committee.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions on that issue? That's primarily an informational issue, as far as I can understand, because I think this committee endorsed that transfer last meeting.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
New business? I don't know of any. Does any committee member know of new business we need to bring up? How about committee member comments? We can start with Mr. Ashton. Any comments?
I just learned something new every time I show up here. I'm amazed. I think if we have any difficulty, it is to kick jump something there to get some final solutions on some things there. It seems like they tend to go longer than they probably should go. So, but maybe with this body here, we can motivate him to do the right thing.
Mr. Reynolds.
It appears that by this letter we got from the federal people, it's going to be the continuous stall deal and going on and on and on. So I don't have any faith in this thing being resolved very quickly.
Thank you. That's it. Mr.
Wallace. Doug, I didn't know if we've had any response from the public on televising our meetings. This has been done now for, what, 2 years maybe? And I don't know if they have ratings or whatever for public access channel, but has it been worthwhile to televise our meetings, considering the cost to do so?
I haven't had any. I'm not aware of anything that indicates how many individuals actually tune in and watch this, whether they watch it live or watch the the recorded version that's put on slow span. I know from staff point, I always go back in and look at them because I don't usually attend, but I would imagine that there are individuals out there who want to know exactly what's happening with their water supply and how we're dealing with it.
I think it's a good idea. I just didn't know if we had any response or any activity at all from the public saying yes or no, continue viewing these types of meetings?
Personally, I'm not aware of any, but, you know, with everybody in this county seems to have a great interest in what happens with local government, so I'm sure about we're being watched. And as Anthony Spina from National Marine Fisheries told me several years ago, he watches all these meetings also.
Oh, great. And he's better informed. Mr. Earing.
Well, the only comment that I would have is I think Chuck says he learns something new every day, so I'm learning something new just about every time we have one of these meetings. I think we might be able to help Tom out. If we ever get enough water up in the dam, we have a real wet year, we can just flood that thing out, and it'll cut a hole down there, and it'll go straight into the ocean.
That's right. Absolutely.
So, you know, there's another way to do this. It'll be a natural function.
Then we'll have to go tow all the vehicles out because they won't be able to get across.
Too bad.
Mr. Costello.
I've got no comments tonight.
Mrs. Dean. The only thing I would do is say is to thank county staff for their response on the quagga mussel issue. I think it's been excellent. Next regular meeting scheduled for Thursday, July 17th, 2008, at Oceano Community Services District. And that is it. We're adjourned.
So moved, huh?